Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alina, who do we have with us today?
Today we have Emma Wells, who is a lecturer in ecclesiastical, I said the word
Boom.
Right, ecclesiastical, taking me 10 minutes to learn it, and architectural history at York University. She specialises in late medieval and Reformation English parish churches, and there's a really long list of what else she specialises in, but we'll be here all day. So her most recent book is titled Pilgrim Roots of the British Isles, and she's in the process of writing another one. So welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And how are you? We've established that you are in the countryside, but that you do have a McDonald's drive-through a mile away.
Yeah, the key point there. I'm doing very well, thank you. It's very sunny here in the Yorkshire Dales. It's just lovely. I can walk, you know, to field, so I'm not doing too badly in these odd.
And tomorrow you can have a McFlurry.
And tomorrow I can have a McFlurry, which is the most important, you know, highlight of my week.
Yeah, first world problems. So you're with us today because we are going to make church history fun.
Yes,
we are.
That's the hope. That's
yeah,
the
hope. You're, I'm excited looking at this list of questions.
Oh, hell yeah.
Alina, go for it.
Yes, yeah, so we're going to start with medieval relics. So can you define to us what is a medieval relic?
Well, traditionally, a relic is, you know, remains of saints, so remains of holy figures, but not just in Christianity, from Christianity all the way through to Buddhism. So in the broadest sense, they can describe any sort of artifact with a greatly religious or significant meaning. And, you know, think holy texts, prayers, think bodily remains, think clothing, garments, you know, anything and everything. So they're there in order to kind of inspire belief. So they were also kind of a bridge between heaven and earth for the medieval worshipper. So you would go to visit a relic, and the whoever saint that relic came from, whether it was his finger bone, whether it was, you know, full body, would allow you to sort of connect to the divine, and he would fulfill a sort of cure for you, or a miracle, or, you know, you might have had a bad harvest, you might have had a bad stomach, you know, he'll get rid of all those things for you.
Where do you find them?
All over. Essentially, you find them in churches, parish churches and cathedrals. So they'd be in these little, or they might be in a really grand shrine or a tomb, you know, big monument with this huge, with the person in it. And, you know, lots of people can come and worship, and they can even kneel. They can kiss as close. They can kiss the shrine. They can get as close as they can to the actual remains, the relics. But also they're in sort of, let's just call it fancy containers, I suppose, display cases as well, that could be paraded around the church, paraded around the town. So essentially churches, really. I mean, you might have a few holy wells, or, you know, in different places, but essentially churches.
Is there a market for these kind of relics?
Absolutely. It was a vast, you know, money-making enterprise. So the way I like to think of it is, think, you know, tourist attractions today, think theme parks, think Alton Towers. The more sort of good relics you have, the more good rides you had, the more people were going to come to your church, the more people would therefore come see your saint, and they would give you money in return. So, you know, in the promise that that saint would fulfill your cure, fulfill your miracle. So it was a vast money-making enterprise. I mean, if you think about the amount of people that were coming there, we'll say like 100,000 visitors came to Canterbury Cathedral the year after Thomas Becket was killed in 1170. So, you know, that's what we're talking. So this is a vast amount of money. And essentially what our great cathedrals were built on, it was built on the money of these. So as a result, people were trading in them. They were borrowing, stealing everything they could in order to get these relics, because the better relic you had, as in like the better theme park, the more people were going to come to your church.
This is brilliant, but it's obviously massively open for corruption, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of time, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of people behind this enterprise. So, you know, think of it, even today, you know, we have celebrity relics, you know, sort of badges of honour. We'll probably come on to that a bit later, but they were badges of honour for churches, and, you know, they were trafficked around Europe as a result. So we had this, you end up with this sort of underground economy of trades, and people sort of surreptitiously purchasing and even, you know, stealing relics, because churchmen could essentially place orders. So you want the better ones, so you have to find them. You have to find the money for them. You might not have the money for them. So what happens is this group comes together. They were called relic fixers or relic merchants. And the most famous we know of was a 9th century Roman deacon named Deus Donna. And he lived near the Basilica of St. Peter and Chains in Rome. And, you know, with his little gang, he would go around sort of sourcing relics and sourcing bodies, you know, for all the monasteries and the churches. But unknown to many of his customers, the brothers would typically acquire bones from the local catacombs because they lived right next door. So they would then sell them on as holy relics. So they might have wanted, I don't know, St. Christopher or whatever, Fingerbone St. Christopher, and they've got, you know, Dave from down the road. Mm. I don't know. So there was lots of corruption here. You know, and then as a result, you get all this, you know, sort of surreptitious goings on underneath. So as a result, you have all this sort of double dealing and people essentially having the same relic twice, three times, actually up to about 50 times. So these were holy antiques. People wanted them. The more that they did was that they would just end up everywhere. So, for example, you might say, okay, how do you know you've got an authentic relic? Well, you don't. And so churches ended up with the same relic 20, 30, 50 times. We have pieces of the true cross all over Europe. And in fact, the 16th century Protestant theologian, John Calvin, he said that if you put them all together, all the pieces would form a whole ship's cargo. Some of them were even claiming there was 29 places asserting to possess the nails on Christ's cross. And we know that he didn't have that many arms and legs. So, you know, that certainly wasn't true. So, you know, as a result, it was just free for all, really. It was what relics you get your hands on. But you might end up with a bone from a human. You might end up with one from a duck.
I love it.
So Glastonbury, you mentioned about finding relics and things, but Glastonbury Abbey, the monks were really struggling for funds at the time. What did they do? And was this more common than we think?
Well, a lot of churches in the medieval era, not that they still do this, of course, you know, when they were struggling to find funds, it's okay, what do we do? What do we do? We need a money-making, you know, enterprise. We need to fundraise, essentially. So at Glastonbury, they wanted to rebuild their church. And it was because there was a sort of cathedral crusade of building in this area. Everyone was doing up their churches. You know, that's why we have these great cathedrals. So, you know, you've got wherever it is down the road. For Glastonbury, we have Westminster Abbey, which was being completely revamped. They want to compete. They want to rival. They want more pilgrims. They want more money. So they happened to stumble upon the skeletons of King Arthur and Guinevere in a tree trunk, as you do. And they relocated the grave into the grounds of the Abbey's new church, the one they were building. And as a result, obviously, everyone came. All the pilgrims were coming to see King Arthur and Guinevere to offer to give money. And therefore, they took all the pilgrims away from, you know, Wells down the road, Wells Cathedral. The site had been, you know, vastly popular for hundreds of years. And so this was a common practice. It was, you know, what can we essentially, you know, dole out? What can we essentially hype up to give us more money? I mean, you know, they would use the saints as a way, as I say, like theme parks, you know, come and see our ride, come and see our new attraction, give us more money, and therefore we can build a better church for you, you know, a more grand setting, a more, you know, grand heavenly house of God. So, you know, that's why they did it. They just kept doing it. And not, you know, if they need a new transept, well, we might have a new saint that we just found down the, you know, down the crypt or wherever it might be. Darling, out.
Oh, so how could you verify them, or did you just have to have faith that they were telling the truth?
Well, technically, you were supposed to have faith in them. Augustine of Hippo, so he was a 4th, 5th century theologian, etc. He said, look, you have to have blind faith, you know, the modern sense of the word. But it was because, you know, in order to verify a relic, it was supposed to have performed miracles. So if, you know, you'd gone to your shrine and then you'd said, I need X cure to happen, or whatever it might be, and that happened after you'd been and visited and offered, then that's your miracle sorted and it's verified. But there were a few snags with this method, you know, because miracles can be faked. I mean, you could say, oh God, I've got a limp, oh my God, I've broken my arm. And then the next day, oh my God, I'm suddenly healed.
I'm like Uncle Albert with the back healer in the market with Del Boy in that episode of Only Fools and Horses with the miracle cure.
That's it. Still goes on today. It really does. You know, you have all the tears of blood and everything like that, which still happens today on statues. Is it real? Is someone just putting tomato ketchup on them? Who knows? But so there was another way that you could confirm the truth about miracles, about relics. But there was one way that you could, that you could verify that relics were real, that they were authentic. You could plunge them into fire. You could have trial by fire, because if you put them into a fire and they, you know, they flamed, they went up in smoke, they weren't real, you know, because relics are horrible. And you could also plunge a hot steak into them. You can plunge them into hot water because, of course, nothing will happen to them. And that's how you authenticated a relic.
It's kind of like the witchcraft thing, though, isn't it? Well, we'll try and drown her. If she does drown, she was innocent.
And then she's screwed anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is just it's the same kind of principle. It's fire, water, all the elements. It's, you know, essentially the house of God protects you.
It's just crazy. But I actually have a question from my dad, who wanted to get himself involved on this podcast because he got excited. He wants to know, is there any evidence of the Knights Templars, so like relics and things, in any of the churches?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, well, it's an interesting one. I mean, lots of, like, I don't know how much your dad knows about, you know, Templar architecture, but there's a lot of evidence of the Knights Templars actually building churches, and therefore, you know, there was relics within them. So, you know, the most famous one is the Knights Templar, what's called the Knights Templar Church, in Dover, above Dover. It sits, it's only sort of really stone foundations now, but it's a small chapel, and that was their chapel. And essentially, Dover was the chief port, you know, going out. So any pilgrims who wanted to go out to the Holy Land would go from Dover. So it was an obvious place for them to hold, you know, property and where they would put all their money. I mean, you know, Templars essentially started the banking system that we know today. But some people say it's a wayside shrine. Some people say it's just chapel of the Holy, of the Templars. But it's what's really interesting about it, it's got a circular nave. It's not, you know, the normal rectangular building. And this is very typical of their churches, because they mirror the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. So, you know, you build the churches in the image of the Holy Sepulchre so that you could essentially take a sort of spiritual pilgrimage. It was, you know, this is the closest you're going to get to Jerusalem without actually taking a dangerous pilgrimage there. So here we go, let's design a church, let's fill it with relics, let's fill it with everything else and our money and everything, and this is where we worship. And same with Temple Church in London. So obviously that's why Temple in London is called Temple, because mm-hmm. that's the Templars inhabited there. And, you know, Temple Church is where they were ordained into the order and everything like that. So that's the greatest one. But, you know, that's as much as we know. But, I mean, another one as well is Roslyn Chapel up in Scotland. You know, there's a lot of really interesting architecture.
It's the Da Vinci Code one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
But unfortunately, a lot of that is crap. That's just...
Yeah. But it is a nice church.
It's a lovely church, and yeah, it's fantastic. And if you want to go in and feel like you're, you know, what's his name?
Robert Langdon.
Brander, that's it. Yeah, if you want to feel like you're him, go into, you know, the church there and Roslyn Chapel and try and decode all that. Yeah, good luck.
So I love this stuff, because some of the nonsense that these churches come out with is just fantastic. So tell us, what is your favorite relic?
Oh god, well, I am sort of renowned for giving this example, but it's because it's so bloody good and it's so god, and people are like, really? But it's the Holy Foreskin, of course. And yes, that's
because that's exactly the bit of him you'd take.
That's about as bad as what was it, Napoleon's penis the other week.
Why is it always with the penises? It must be men that come up with these things, because women are not fixated on them like this. I know they like to think we are, but we're just not fixated on it. So who was it that was purporting to have the Holy Foreskin?
I'm just thinking this is the medieval example of a dick pic.
Yeah.
It isn't. No, well, Jesus, what it pertains to is Jesus' circumcision is said to have taken place about 8 days after his birth. So what happened to his foreskin? Of course, everyone wants to know the answer. So it became a holy relic, obviously, because it was a part of Christ's body. And, there were first-class relics, which were actually the bodily, the body remains, the body itself. Then you had second-class relics, which were essentially garments, objects, artifacts related to the saints or martyrs or Christ, whatever it is. And then third-class relics were anywhere they touched or been in the vicinity. So the foreskin was obviously a first-class relic. And so after it had gone, after he'd been circumcised, many churches or several claimed to have it in their possession. Its first mention came when Charlemagne presented it as a gift to Pope Leo III.
Just what you want for Christmas.
I mean, why not? No one else has got.
Yeah, this is true.
But then again, as we always see, there are rival foreskins all over across Europe.
Sorry, I just never thought I'd ever hear that line in my life. Rival foreskins.
One is better than the other. I don't know. All told, there were at least 31 churches asserting to house the holy foreskin in the Middle Ages. Most notorious.
What kind of things did they claim it did, these 31 churches?
Didn't really do anything. It's just, it was just important to have, really. And one of the saints, and her name is escaping me, I can't remember which saint it was, she even possessed that she had it around her finger as a wedding ring. And then it was also claimed to be the rings around Uranus.
Sorry.
Oh, dear. What's the creepiest one you've ever come across? That is quite creepy, to be fair.
It depends what we mean by creepy, I suppose. I mean, St. Anthony's tongue is a little bit odd. So St. Anthony of Padua, he died in 1231 and was then exhumed about 30 years later, and he hadn't decomposed. His body had decomposed, but his tongue hadn't decomposed. Just his tongue was left. So obviously it's supposed to have been a miraculous sign that he of his speaking and teaching of the word of God, essentially. That's why essentially only the tongue is there. But he was then exhumed again, I think it was in the 80s, and it was still there. All the vocal cords material, all the vocal apparatus was still there. So that's a little bit weird.
There's got to be one where it proves that it's completely genuine. Is there?
You mean in what way are we saying genuine, though?
So, can they really, claim the provenance that it's part of the true cross or that it is the bones of a particular saint?
Well, there are some that are actually, we have the entire bodily, how do we prove it? Yeah, that's still difficult because someone could have just swapped, John down the road for whoever it might be. But there are, for example, St. Francis of Xavier, his entire body is still on display in Goa, and he died in the 16th century. And, he was one of the first Jesuit missionaries. And in fact, every 10 years, his entire body, it's in a sort of glass cabinet, is put on public display and thousands of people line up to kiss his body, and there's a big procession, and they even have tight security, so as if it's like, I don't know, BTS or something, just don't get too close to.
Yeah.
I'm creeped out by that. That's actually really gross.
You see a photo of it, it's not the nicest thing to look at. I'm not sure I would want to get too close to, the 500-year-old body, but 400-year-old body, but. Yeah.
I'm loving this. Tell us about some more of your favourites.
We have Margaret of Clitheroe. There's her withered hand. And you can go and see that in York. So she was essentially against church in the 16th century. So there are a lot of... They're all kind of weird bodily parts, if you see what I mean. So a lot of heads on display, a lot of teeth. How do we know that they are real? That's an interesting one. There's no sign of authenticity. There's no, it doesn't come with the, you know, certificate of authenticity. So it's an interesting one. And, you know, I think I kind of get immune to them because I've seen so many. It's just like there's a head here, there's an arm here, you know? So to me, it's not that weird.
When do people wake up to this? And when, I'm guessing it's going to be Thomas Cromwell is the instigator, but when does this relic culture begin to collapse and why?
Well, sort of, I mean, technically it's still happening today. Mm. So do we say it ever really, you know, did it ever really fall? But yeah, beginning, it's an interesting one because it starts, it's part of the Reformation, that's to say, you know, it starts back with this, as I was talking about before, you know, relic stealing, you know, all the fake relics, all this happening. It was part of the kind of corruption of the Catholic Church. So it was a movement, it was part of the movement which sparked the Reformation, and obviously in the UK, sorry, in England, continued into the 1530s when Henry VIII broke with Rome. And we saw the attack on pilgrimage, relics, reliquary shrines, the veneration of images, all that happened. So it was essentially stopped in the late 1530s. But, you know, what's interesting is, you know, you go from toddling off on pilgrimage or down to your local shrine for, you know, all your life, suddenly you're told that you can't do that anymore and that you don't have faith in that. It's an interesting one. So did it ever really stop? And in fact, you know, shrines did continue. A lot of them were dismantled, like a lot of saint shrines were dismantled, obviously, at the Reformation. But still things continued on. And then they came back and they went and they came back and they went. Some were turned into more secular artifacts. Some were even turned into secular objects. So you might have relics hidden within like chalices that you would say the mass with. And you know, you have these fancy, really fancy chalice cups, you know, all gilded, and you would take them all apart and then they would become the reliquary caskets. So they're kind of like, you know, hidden, you know, objects really, and put into really weird places that, you know, people could never see. And it's like, oh, there's a tiny little bone in that cup. Oh yeah. So that's essentially what it was. But it you know, when you get into the Victorian era, when you get to the early 19th century, once the Enlightenment had passed, sort of there was a trade again in unsanctioned relics. You see this all start to happen again. But in fact, the Catholic Church continued the requirement for all altars to house relics until the 1969. So, I mean, this was the other reason why they were so proliferate, was because, you know, you had to have a relic on your altar to sort of, I suppose, authenticate your high altar as well. But as I say, still going until 1969. So there you go. And as I say, and still going on today, people like weird and wacky, wonderful things.
Yeah, I was going to say, have we not kind of renamed or rebranded that to memorabilia?
Yeah, I mean, it is really. People still today, I suppose they go on pilgrimage, don't they? They go on long journeys to see objects and artifacts, still do today. It has moved on and it has become the sort of modern concept. I mean, God, there are interesting ones, such as 2006, a little pebble about the size of a raisin sold at auction for $25,000. And you might think, ooh, what's, you know, something fun. Maybe this was Christ's, you know, kidney or something. No, it was William Shatner's kidney stone. So someone actually bought William Shatner's kidney stone. I think it was a casino or something. They had like a celebrity, you know, I don't know, museum or something. Yeah, they did, because they had was it a cheese sandwich that was graced with an image of the Virgin Mary along, you know, as part of their collection. So, you know. Whatever floats your boat.
Just like you do.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't pay much for Virgin Mary on a cheese toastie, but, you know, someone else might.
Apart from relics in churches, you find so many other things, for example, etchings, carvings, paintings, etc. There are a few there that are out of the box. So let's just quickly talk about some of them. Why don't we start with, because Alina wants me to start with, the North Nave Isle of York Minster.
Yeah. Okay, well, the North Nave Isle of York Minster houses the pilgrimage window. And that's dated to around 1330, 1335. And it's named after, there's a depiction of the crucifixion in its main lights, in its main panels. And then this is cited above male or female pilgrims which flank St. Peter. And St. Peter is obviously the patron saint of York Minster. So that's why it's called that. But around the borders, or what we call the margins, if you look at the window, it looks a bit like an illuminated manuscript page. You'll see, as I say, round the sides, round the borders, are these borders, are these margins of amazing little images, which you wouldn't notice were there. You wouldn't even perhaps see them unless you were looking straight at it. And within them is a load of amusing imagery. So there is a funeral procession of monkeys. There's squirrels. There's also a monkey holding up, there's quite a few monkeys holding up flasks, sort of little round glass bottle sort of things. And you think, what's he doing? Well, that is urine. There's also a fox preaching to a cock, a parody of a hunt chasing and hunt of a stag chasing a hound, a fox stealing a goose pursued by a woman, and then an archer and some other things. So everything's kind of back to front as well. And it's because the kind of morality tales, the kind of allegorical images to say, you know, warnings, this is how you should act. But monkeys particularly are really interesting because they're actually used throughout medieval imagery. They're often represented doing human-like activities, you know, playing instruments, playing games, hunting, eating, drinking. And they're there to suggest the folly of man, because, you know, in Christian tradition, they were apes, were seen as thoughtless, compulsive imitators of human action. So, you know, gluttony, you know, vanity, foolishness, that's what we think of. You think of, you know, aping behavior, and that's where that comes from. So they're also there to ape doctors of physics, because it was kind of felt that we didn't really have the, you know, the medical profession as we do today. And it was felt that only Christ could cure the souls of man. But you got a lot of these doctors of physic, as they were called, who would, you know, supposed to cure you of different things. So, you know, it's kind of taking the piss, essentially, out of man and the idiotic things that we do, and warning you not to keep on doing them, essentially.
I mean, it doesn't get any better, really, with the parish church of All Saints in Easton on the Hill, does it?
No. As you wander past the church, you know, lovely church, you look up, there's a man, well, carving of a man sticking his backside out on top of you, you know, towards you. Now, the legend is that he's sticking his bum towards Peterborough Cathedral, because supposedly, you know, he's the stonemason. He wasn't paid by the stonemason at Peterborough Cathedral. But actually, mooning men can be found all over churches. Like, not everywhere, but, you know, they are quite common. This sort of dates of about the 14th century. Now, these are grotesques, usually. They might be gargoyles. So the difference is gargoyles are essentially have a water spout. So some of them do have a water spout, so you can get rained on out of the man's area.
Go on, Emma, say it. Penis. Go on.
Well, no, is anus, in fact.
Oh! But
his penis too. Yes, there are penises too. And so, you know, because he's got his bum out, you see, and then the spout comes between the cheeks. So, but the general purpose of him, we don't entirely know, but there's one of the things is people did moon at each other in the Middle Ages, just, you know, why not? But it was kind of, you hear this in Shakespeare and Chaucer and things where they, you know, kissing her behind, you know, essentially that's what we say, like, you know, someone's kissed your ass kind of thing. But there's also the belief that they are sort of protective, apotropaic symbols, that is what we call them, that they're there to warn off devils or warn off sin. So, you know, protective kind of carvings for anyone coming into the church, any evil spirits getting into the church, and they therefore you're cocking a snook, the devil.
The Church of St. Mary and St. David at Kilpeck in Herefordshire. Is this an interesting one?
Oh, yes. It's probably one of the most famous churches, particularly for one of its well-known images, which is of one of England's best preserved Sheilana Giggs, which is a bit of a tongue twister. Now, these are usually figurative stone carvings, sometimes in woods, of a naked woman with her legs open, exposing her genitalia. So the name likely comes from the Irish, which means Sheila of the breast, because of course she's naked as well. So you find these particularly above doorways and windows, not just on churches, you can see them on castles, yeah, maybe a couple of townhouses occasionally, but mainly more of the larger buildings. And again, we see them about 11th to 17th century, but obviously they look very erotic in nature, and you're thinking, why is this lady flashing me? But again, we think they're sort of, they might be apotropaic, they might be protective, but particularly they're likely symbols of fertility. So warnings against lust. So I think also it's a bit of fun as well. So, you know, it's, they were removed, they were destroyed, they were covered over. So clearly not everyone was okay with them, you know, all the time. But really the carver's having fun, but also, you know, the warnings. We still do these things today. I mean, there are grotesques and gargoyles of like Alien from Predator. There's, God, what else is there? Star Wars characters and things. So we're still doing it today.
There's also the really weird hidden sexual things in Disney as well, isn't there?
Oh, God, yeah.
Is where there? They have a laugh and hide things. Just Google the Little Mermaid dirty stuff, Alina.
Oh, my God,
not
I'm
now, though.
So do that.
Not now, because we've got one more church.
So the last church we've got to ask you about is the Church of St. Thomas and St. Edmund in Salisbury.
Well, so above the chancel arch is a, you know, very powerful mural, a wall painting that you can see immediately upon entry. It's actually just been restored, so it looks even better. Dated to 1475, it's one of the largest dune paintings. Now, these were really quite common in parish churches in the medieval era. They're essentially Last Judgment paintings. They're essentially, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't wise up and come to church and do as you're told. And, you know, there's a big mouth of hell and all the, you know, all the souls being, you know, fried on a pitchfork and, you know, all that kind of stuff, good stuff. And the reason being is that obviously when you went into the church, the nave, you know, the main part where the congregation sits, that was your part. You couldn't go any further. You couldn't go up to the chancel where the high altar was. So it's just at that line where you can't go into to say, you know, do as you're told. But what's really interesting about the Salisbury one is in the bottom right-hand corner, I believe it is, there's a dishonest alewife and she's got a jug in her hand. She's hugging a demon. And the reason is that she's doomed to hell, obviously, for eternity, because she's in hell. But it was believed that alewives encompassed a multitude of sins. I suppose they still do, really, but encouraging idleness and overindulgence, tempting with provocative clothing and overt displays of wealth, greed and excess, not to mention corruption. So, you know, they're talking about they overcharge customers, they watered down ale. So it's kind of an, you know, metaphor.
Having been a bar manager, I will not confirm or deny any of those allegations.
Someone who works in the club as well. I could.
Yeah. I've just said never put money behind a bar. That's all I'm saying, people.
Oh, yeah.
If I can impart one bit of knowledge to the rest of humanity, never put money behind a bar.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because this is essentially where the kind of seductive, you know, temptress comes from as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, those looking for a interesting party, you know, come along to the buxom wench, you know, think of the German buxom wench as well. This is kind of where it all, you know, stems from. It's showing that, you know, anything that you do during, you know, lifetime, well, everything counts on the day of judgment, but, you know, watch out for your sins and there is no redemption. You know, watch out, you know, don't do all this bad stuff or you'll be
fine.
It's
one of those outer circles in hell reserved for us then, Emma, and all other bartenders. Emma, thank you so much for coming on and brightening up church history for us. It's been great. I love it. Just mad body parts and naughty carvings.
That's essentially what it's all about.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks so much.
Thanks ever so much for having me.
Join us tomorrow when we will take you on a Caribbean jaunt. We are going to be talking to Nick Ramos, who hosts a Cuban revolutionary podcast about the island's history from before Columbus through to about 1895. There's a reason for that specific date, but join us for that because we had great fun with him. He's a really good storyteller and we learned so much. You can now nominate History Hack for an award. if you go to britishpodcastawards.com, you can nominate us for a Listener's Choice Award. You have to do your vote by the 6th of July 2020, and they will announce the winner at the British Podcast Awards on Saturday, the 11th of July 2020. So if you wouldn't mind, we'd really appreciate it. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower, and I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders. Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.